Morning. Are counsel ready? Please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Walt Smittinger. I'm here on behalf of Shirley Smith in her appeal of a workers' compensation action against James Thompson. The Industrial Accident Board's decision in this case again brings before the court the opportunity to address Lolita Gilliard Belfast versus Wendy's and the circumstances under which it applies in the workers' compensation context. Before the Industrial Accident Board, the facts were that the claimant was instructed in early 2005 by her treating physician to stay out of work and to go see a surgeon for evaluation of surgery. She was to follow up with Dr. Hermanton at that time. Previously, she had seen Dr. Duchettle and had been told that she would eventually need surgery for her work-related condition. She, at the time of the hearing, the work note from Dr. Ballou, her then treating pain management physician, was that of no work. She had only just recently seen Dr. Hermanton within a week of the Industrial Accident Board hearing, so we had very limited information before the board about what had gone on there, and the board actually sustained an objection to Ms. Smith's testimony regarding her understanding of Dr. Hermanton's plan.
As I understand it, your key argument is that where a doctor instructs a claimant not to go back to work, the claimant's entitled to rely on that unless and until the board rules otherwise.
That's true.
All right. I'm just trying to understand how this argument fits into the facts of this case. In this case, on what date was the instruction given, the one that you're claiming is critical here?
Dr. Ballou issued a no-duty slip February 2nd of 2005,
okay,
concurrent with a referral for surgical
evaluation. And the board came out the other way in late April of 2005, correct?
They rejected Dr. Ballou's opinion and declined to award benefits.
So is it the case that what's at stake in this case is basically 3 months of disability from February, I'm sorry, 2 months from February through late April?
From the beginning of February through the date of the board's decision, that's correct.
And that's it, correct? We're not talking about any longer period.
At this time, that's right. Whether we go back to the board on other issues is a separate question. At the time of that hearing.
Okay. And what would that amount to dollar-wise? I don't see any of that in the brief.
It's not. If I may, Your Honor. Her compensation rate is $200 a week.
So we're talking about 8 weeks, roughly? At the most?
I think it's closer to 12, but approximately 3 months.
So somewhere between $1,600 and $2,400?
The math is approximate, yes, sir.
Okay, and that's it?
Yes.
That's what this is about.
All right.
Is it your position that no matter how unreasonable a no-work order may be, that the claimant is entitled to total disability benefits while that's in effect?
I think the limit that the court has put on that, it was most recently articulated in the Baker decision where they said, assuming the doctor acts in good faith, I mean, anything short of a fraudulent obtaining of a work note by the claimant or some problem, some actual act of bad faith on the part of the doctor, the claimant's entitled to rely on that. Yes, I think that's the limit the court has placed.
Well, so causation is not part of that?
Causation is, as a threshold question, and Your Honor brings up the board's attempt to rule on this case on a causation basis rather than a Gilliard-Belfast basis. This case has long been accepted as compensable. Causation has not been in question for many years. There isn't any doctor here who says her present condition is unrelated to the work accident, including the defense evaluating physician. So it is an unsupported stretch that the board makes that her present condition is not causally related to the work injury. The question is what are the appropriate work restrictions that are the result of that condition? And that's a question that directly implicates Gilliard Belfast up to the point in time where the board makes a ruling. So causation, to illustrate the counterpoint, this was an original petition for benefits. The treating physician had taken the doctor out, and the board finds that the claimant did not sustain an industrial accident, was hurt outside of work. That's the threshold causation question, and you never get to whether the doctor's restrictions are appropriate or should be followed under Gilliard Belfast, because the matter is not compensable in any event. But we're not here. That doesn't describe this case.
Does the Caballero case decided in May of this year have any bearing on the outcome of this appeal?
I don't know that it does, Your Honor. I'm not sure I have that one immediately in front of me. I think the problem that arises in this case in particular is Flax and Karen King. The Superior Court in this case relied on the Karen King decision, which itself not expressly but certainly did rely on this Court's decision in Flax, which has subsequently been backed away from in this Court's decision in Baker in August of 2005. I think in the Baker decision, they were most, the court was again definitive, as they had been in Gilliard Belfast and as they had been in the Clements decision, that when the treating doctor imposes a no work note, the claimant's out of work until the board rules otherwise. They can either accept that and continue total disability benefits, or they can reject that, and total disability benefits end as of the date of the board's decision. But the court has been clear, I think, on how those have been treated. And more definitively so as time goes on. The Karen King...
Well, you're saying that the King and Flax basically misinterpreted the earlier Supreme Court case.
I think that's right.
Because those cases held that where the purpose of the no-work order is simply to enable the claimant to get a diagnosis, that's not enough. There has to be some definitive, according to those cases, some definitive determination that surgery is required or some kind of hospitalization.
That's right.
Your argument is it doesn't matter.
True.
As long as the doctor issues a no-work order, claimant's entitled to rely on it until the board holds otherwise. My question is this. Doesn't that a rule like that presuppose that we're talking about a bona fide doctor's order, that is, a doctor's order that's based on a bona fide medical reason?
I think that's right, and I think that's what the court was saying in Baker when it said as long as the doctor acts in good faith.
If that's the case, then isn't the board entitled, if that's the right word, to test whether or not a doctor's order is bona fide?
I don't think...
Suppose, for example, the doctor said, well, I don't know what your situation is. Or suppose the doctor says, well, I think you can actually go back to work, but because I'm a nice guy, I'm going to write a no-work order. Isn't the board entitled to determine whether that occurred factually?
I think that goes to the question of good faith. I think the board does have the authority to do that, and I think the board did not do that in this case. They didn't find that it wasn't a matter. I mean, there was no, the note wasn't in bad faith, or at least the board did not so find.
But didn't they say there was an alternative reason for it?
It's interesting.
Health and Social Services and Medicaid.
Because what the court said was that what the board said was that there's an alternative. There's a possible alternative reason for Dr. Nathan's note, who's Dr. Ballou's partner, and that's the social services form that was filled out. The thing about it is that the next month, prior to that, she had seen Dr. Ballou, and Dr. Ballou had noted that symptomatically she was worse and that if that continued, he was going to refer for a surgical evaluation. In between, we have Dr. Nathan's filling out of a form. In February of 2005, when she's seen again by Dr. Ballou, she is in fact worse. Dr. Ballou follows through on his suggestion that she needs a surgical evaluation, and he takes her out of work at that point. So even if there's some question about the social services note written by another physician who didn't testify on January 10th of 2005, that doesn't impact or invalidate the opinion of Dr. Ballou in February that was explained, the reasons for which were explained and which was not questioned by the Industrial Accident Board in terms of Dr. Ballou's good faith.
But the board didn't accept that recital of facts, did it? Didn't the board find that that Dr. Nathans, is that who it was?
Dr. Nathans, the partner, yes, sir.
Yeah, issued this no work order for different purposes. And then Dr. Ballou inexplicably reversed course and issued a no work order, unable to explain why his partner did it.
Well, I don't know that it's inexplicable because Dr. Ballou...
Well, didn't they find it was inexplicable?
I think that the board concentrated on Dr. Nathan's note rather than and found that Dr. Ballou couldn't explain Dr. Nathan's note and didn't explain Dr. Nathan's note. But that still leaves the claimant in the very same untenable position as the claimant in Gilliard Belfast, where you've got she has this choice. She's been given a no-work note and a referral to a surgeon. Does she follow it or doesn't she? And does she run the risk of losing her benefits on the one hand or risking further injury and doing further damage and losing coverage for that on the other? That's the untenable position. That's why the claimant has to be – that's why Gilliard Belfast told the claimant which way she has a right to go under those circumstances. So, yes, in retrospect, the board looked at this and didn't accept it, and that's fine. As to circumstances going forward from the date of the board's decision, but that still leaves the claimant in the lurch up to the time the board makes the decision. That's what Gilliard Belfast says.
Well, the claimant testified that she asked Dr. Nathans to sign this no work order so that she could get food stamps and other benefits unrelated to workers' comp. So she wasn't relying on Dr. Nathans for workers' compensation purposes, that is, for disability, was she?
Well, I'm not sure that it's unrelated to workers' comp in the sense that she was out of work as a result of her work injury and needed that
support. But she was laid off, not as a result of her work injury.
She was not immediate. She had a problem getting back to work. She's under serious work restrictions. I mean, people right. In this situation don't lose their job on Friday and started a new
what
one
I'm concerned
Monday.
About is that the facts in this case seem to be on a rolling basis. I mean, they seem to be whatever you would like them to be, but you're not focusing on what was found as fact. And that's what makes it hard to follow your argument.
The Industrial Accident Board found that there may be other reasons for Dr. Nathan's note on January 10th. The fact that Dr. Ballou didn't write a note for social services on February 2nd means that alternative basis isn't available. I don't know as to Dr. Ballou's note. Now, I don't know that the board specifically focused on that.
Well, Dr. Ballou, who had not done this before, now all of a sudden writes a no-work note after his partner wrote one.
And even though
Dr. Ballou couldn't explain why his partner did it. That much is admitted, right?
That's true, yes.
Okay.
He also made a surgical referral that the partner hadn't done. I mean, Dr. Ballou is focusing on treatment at that point and worsening symptoms in the face of a herniated disc on MRI and a positive discogram and a prior surgeon saying she's going to need surgery eventually. Dr. Ballou says, okay, your complaints have continued to be worse over a couple of visits. It's time to get you looked at by the surgeon.
What did the board find with regard to the bona fides of Dr. Ballou's no-work order on February 2?
I don't think that the board found Dr. Ballou's February 2nd note not to be bona fide. I mean, they questioned the motives of Dr. Nathan's January 10th note, and they were... I think there was an absence. I mean, Dr. Ballou couldn't testify because it wasn't his note on January 10th. And the board noted that they simply didn't know the basis for that. And frankly, it appears somewhat speculative for the board to say that it may have been not bona fide if, in fact, that was their ruling. I don't know that they said that expressly,
well,
but I think that's an inference.
Didn't Dr. Ballou, when he saw the claimant after Dr. Nathan, note that her condition was unchanged?
He said that the physical examination was unchanged. He also said that the symptoms were worse. And in the context of a positive MRI and a positive discogram, I don't know that those are inconsistent. I mean, the other thing is she didn't have a follow-up MRI in terms of her objective findings either.
And but in January, he had encouraged her to continue to look for work.
He said that she was still released as of that time, but if she continued to be worse, he would refer her for a surgical evaluation at the next visit. That's right. So he was contemplating, even at that point, that this may be not just a relatively modest ebb and flow of the condition, but a progression such that it may be time to move on to that next step that Dr. DeShuttle had contemplated previously of surgery.
The board found, and I'm referring to page 8 of the board's decision, the last line, which says, although Dr. Ballou later continued the period of disability in February 2005, he neither explained a factual basis for the imposition nor clarified Dr. Nathan's rationale on the new period of total disability.
Okay. He did say, now I realize the board made those findings, that Dr. Ballou did say that she was referred for a surgical evaluation and that her symptoms had worsened even though her physical exam had stayed the same. So I'm not sure that that means the board, that Dr. Ballou didn't say why he did it. The board findings being what they are, I still don't think that amounts to bad faith. Is that not bona fide? Is that, and it's interesting too. I might point out that in Clements versus Diamond State Port Corporation, we have exactly the same factual.
Well, are we to reject that finding of fact?
Excuse me?
The one that I read to you from.
No, sir. No, I don't think you need to reject it. I think that it isn't relevant to, I mean, unless it rises to a finding by the board that Dr. Ballou's no work note is in bad faith, I don't think that it rises to supersede Gilliard Belfast. It doesn't get to the point where the claimant no longer has the right to rely on that.
Well, should bad faith be the test, or should it be a rational basis for it?
Well, the court said in Baker that it's bad faith. I mean, in the absence of good faith by the doctor, the claimant has the right to rely on that. And frankly, I think it should be a high threshold like bad faith, simply because here's the claimant. She's got a note from her doctor, and she needs to know what to do.
Let me put it another way. If a no-work order is entered without a rational basis for it, is that not in good faith?
I think if the board were to make that finding, we would have a very different case. I think that in light of Baker, we would be in a much more difficult position under those circumstances.
You're well into your rebuttal period, which you're welcome to use.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. One final comment. I would note that in Clements, that was a case in which the claimant was treating with a pain management physician, and the pain management physician noted an increase in symptoms, took the claimant out of work, and referred for surgical evaluation. In that case, the board denied benefits, and this court reversed, saying the claimant had the right to rely on that. We're in the very same situation here. Thank you, members of the court. I appreciate the time.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Lagello, and I represent the appellee in this case, James Thompson and Company. As you know, the standard of review in this case is whether the board had substantial evidence to issue its ruling and whether a reasonable mind could conclude, as the board did, that the evidence showed that claimant's petition should be denied. We submit to you.
I don't understand why this is an evidentiary issue as opposed to an issue of law with respect to was there or was there not a no-work order, and if there was a no-work order, was it invalid for some reason?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that based on the questions from the court and the responses of Mr. Schmittinger, that there is an issue regarding that work order and whether that work order was valid, as noted in the court's decision in the Delhaize versus Baker case. In this case with Shirley Smith, what you have is a doctor who's not her treating physician, Dr. Nathan, issuing a disability note without any explanation as to why he did that. A disability note only provides that she's disabled for 6 to 12 months based upon no physical examination. And 5 days earlier, when she's into her treating physician's office with Dr. Ballou, he's encouraging her to continue to work and to find jobs within her restrictions. Dr. Ballou's testimony is that he has no understanding as to why Dr. Nathan issued that work note, and there was no physical examination. So the basis of the petition that was filed by the claimant was that her benefits would run from January 10th, 2005, when Dr. Nathan issued that note, ongoing. And since that note has a question that the employer or the carrier can question because of its validity, I think it becomes an issue as to whether the board had substantial evidence to rule on the causation issue. And what the board essentially...
Wait a second. I thought that you only get to the question of... The question of causation is not really what matters if there is a no work order and there's an industrial accident. Then the only question is whether that no work order was entered in bad faith. Am I mistaken here?
I think that under the case law, to prove a recurrence of total disability, you have to prove a causal relationship between the work accident and the disability. And in this case, the causal relationship is questioned based on that specific no work note of Dr. Nathan. And that's the point I'm trying to argue.
Causation is not whether you have a work note or not, a no work note or not. Causation is, are your injuries the result of the industrial accident? Didn't the board find that the injuries were related sufficiently to warrant compensation?
In this case, there was an agreement that she had an injury with respect to the recurrence. The board did not find that there was adequate causation to relate the recurrence to the work accident. And it would be our position that that is based upon Dr. Nathan's note of January 10th, 2005, without adequate explanation for the purposes behind that note. And we learned at the hearing that the purposes behind that note were so that the claimant could collect benefits that were unrelated to workers' compensation.
Okay,
so I think it draws a causation
let's
issue.
Let's forget about the note, okay? The petitioner says, I want permanent disability benefits, right?
Correct.
And the initial question, I would think, is, do you have something wrong with you that is the result of or related to an original industrial accident, right?
Initially, yes.
Okay. And that was found that there was something that related to the initial accident, wasn't it?
No, not by the Industrial Accident Board, not by the Superior Court, and not by the competing physician, Dr. Barish, who noted that she had problems, but that she was not disabled in terms of a recurrence of total disability. Did she have an injury? Yes. Did she have ongoing problems? Yes.
Okay, all right. So maybe I'm not articulating it well. What I'm saying is that issue number one is you've got something wrong with you, is whatever it is, whether it's a total disability or just a headache, you know, but if whatever it is that you have wrong with you, is that related to, is it causally related to an industrial accident? That was found in the petitioner's favor, wasn't it?
There was no dispute that she had a problem. That's correct.
Okay, fine. So the next question is, are you disabled?
Are you disabled as a result,
of
your work accident?
Right, okay. And as to that, you're saying that the board found, well, you're not disabled because your doctor's note is invalid?
I believe that that is the case, yes. I believe that there was not enough evidence presented by the claimant to meet the burden of proof.
Okay, fine. So if you have a petitioner who the board ultimately determines is not disabled and is not entitled to recover, does that address the question of the Wendy's case? And, you know, what does that person do from the time his or her doctor says, you better not work anymore because you've got something wrong with you, until the time that the board says, no, we don't think you've got a compensable injury here and that you're disabled? At that point, obviously, the claimant can do what they want in terms of listening to their doctor or not. But isn't the Wendy's case saying that during that interim period, the petitioner is entitled to rely on a doctor's note?
I think the Wendy's case states that they're entitled to rely upon their note. However, I think the Wendy's case is limited to the facts of that case regarding a treating surgeon who was going to disable a claimant pending surgery that was going to occur within a few weeks of the date of his disability note. In this case, you've got someone who's not the treating doctor, Dr. Nathan, issuing a disability note that's questionable because it references no physical examination.
Okay, I understand the argument that this note shouldn't be considered a valid note for purposes of the Wendy's rule, if you will. And we can discuss that. But isn't that really the only question, in the sense that if somebody shows up and says, I want to be found to have been disabled, and I've got a doctor's note, so during the time from, I filed this petition until the time the board heard it, I was relying on my doctor by not working. Now if the board says, no, you're not disabled, that's a different story, but under the Wendy's case, I get paid for the interim period of time when I listen to my doctor.
I would suggest that Wendy's has been clarified subsequently by the Delhaize versus King decision.
The
Superior Court decision, which ruled that in the Delhaize case, a referral for a surgical consult was not the same as a referral for surgery as was done in the Wendy's case. Furthermore, in the Flax versus...
But in Wendy's, wasn't the whole point that a claimant should not be put in a position of having to ignore their doctor's orders at the risk of losing their benefits?
That was one of the policy considerations of Wendy's, given the fact that the claimant was pending surgery and given the fact that both doctors thought that the surgical procedure was reasonable. Also in the Wendy's case, as I read it, what is noted is that the employer had an opportunity to mitigate its damages by agreeing to a surgical procedure that its own doctor felt was reasonable, chose not to do that, and then tried to argue that the employee was not entitled to ongoing disability benefits up until the date of the surgery.
Mr. Lagulo, I'd just like to get at Justice Berger's question a slightly different way. You're arguing that basically the Wendy's doctrine doesn't apply here because the Wendy's case is limited to circumstances where the doctor's work order is based on an or at least is preceded by a decision to undertake surgery. That is, the decision to get surgical treatment has already been made. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, Your Honor.
Suppose, for the sake of argument, that this court were to rule that that is not a valid limitation, that is, it isn't a correct reading of the Wendy's case. What would be your position then, in terms of whether or not this claimant was entitled to rely not on Dr. Nathan's January note, but on Dr. Ballou's note that was written on February 2nd?
My position would be then that Flax versus the state of Delaware would control, and then under the Flax decision, if there are competing medical opinions, as there were in this case, and conflicting evidence, as there is in this case, that the board is the ultimate arbiter of the period of disability that she is claiming an entitlement to.
But isn't that why we have the Wendy's rule? If you have two doctors that have a reasonable man's disagreement or woman's disagreement on what the proper course of medical treatment should be, you don't put the claimant in the middle of that dispute. The claimant can rely on the doctor who's treating her.
Well, that's the public policy of Wendy's, but Wendy's also creates a negative public policy against the employer. And if you adopt a bright-line rule that there is an undisputed disability noted by the claimant's treating doctor, then the employer has no effective way to challenge that. And it creates
Are you saying that we should abolish the Wendy's or overrule the Wendy's case?
I think Wendy's can apply in a factually specific scenario where a treating surgeon notes that a claimant is going to have surgery.
All right, we understand that, and I'm saying assume that we reject that argument. Assume that we conclude that Wendy's would otherwise apply here. What would be your position?
My position would be that Wendy's shouldn't apply in this case according to the Flax versus State of Delaware case, where there are competing medical opinions, and that the board should be the ultimate decider of those competing medical opinions if there's a legitimate dispute, and there is a legitimate dispute in this case.
Is there a basis in this record for the board to conclude that Dr. Ballou did not believe that the claimant was totally disabled when he issued the no work order?
I think that there is a basis in the record, and that falls squarely on Dr. Nathan's disability note that was issued less than a month earlier based on no physical exam. I think that there's a basis for the board to conclude that Dr. Ballou was following through with Dr. Nathan's recommendations for disability. And if that disability was based upon another reason unrelated to workers' compensation, then I think the board has adequate justification in denying benefits subsequent to Dr. Nathan's total disability note.
But did they make a finding? Did anybody make a finding that Dr. Ballou did not believe that the claimant was totally disabled?
It's not specifically noted in the decision, but I think it can be inferred.
What do we make of Dr. Ballou's, well, the what we're told is Dr. Ballou's testimony or the evidence in the record that Dr. Ballou had recommended a surgical consult, that is, that he was issuing this no work order in February to give his client the opportunity to determine get an opinion on whether or not she should have surgery.
That's really an interesting point.
What's the answer?
Well, the answer that I have is that Dr. Ballou doesn't know whether or not she's going to be disabled because no surgeon testified in this case that she was a surgical candidate and that she was going to have surgery.
Understood. He was saying stay out of work until we can find out.
Correct. He was saying that, but he also noted that if the surgeon was of the opinion that the claimant did not need surgery, then he would have no problem releasing her to return to work.
Right. So, but isn't she entitled to rely on that no work order? Or to put it differently, is it bad faith or a no work order issued without any rational basis?
Is it no
work order? Where the record showed that its purpose was to enable her to get an opinion.
Well, the no work order that was initially issued, which the claimant filed her petition on, was the January 10th note. And that note did not have any explanation.
I know you keep on going back to that, but I'm cutting those two off and focusing solely on Dr. Ballou's note, which I understand was accompanied, at least on the record, by testimony that he issued it to enable his patient to get an opinion. Was there such testimony?
There was such testimony, Your Honor.
Doesn't that give at least a rational basis for his issuing that note?
Certainly. It does give a rational basis for the reasons as to why he's issuing that note.
A finding of bad faith or an inference of bad faith?
I think that's an issue for the board to decide based upon the initial note of Dr. Nathan and Dr. Ballou's motivations for issuing the subsequent disability. Whether it was a continuation of Dr. Nathan's note or it was in fact a determination for the need for surgery.
And we don't have any finding one way or the other on that point by the board, do we?
We do not. But we do have the inference from Dr. Nathan from the board's interpretation of Dr. Nathan's note that note was an invalid note or a questionable note with respect to causation and this actual work accident and the recurrence of total disability.
Let me follow up on some of the policy points that you were discussing. What would be the problem with a fairly bright line rule that arguably already was set forth in Wendy's that says it doesn't matter ultimately whether the board says you are disabled or you aren't? If your doctor says you can't work, then you're entitled to rely on that unless there's bad faith on the part of the doctor, and you get benefits for the limited period of time from the no work order until the board decides otherwise. What's the harm in that?
I'll characterize it as significant harm because it creates a continuous period of total disability in which the claimant will never or could never be off of disability. And I can explain this. Essentially, what would happen is the claimant would be given a disability note. The claimant would then go to its employer and say, I have
a
disability. The employer, if you find that there's a bright line test and an unrebuttable presumption under Wendy's, in all cases, the employer would be then compelled to pay disability benefits until there was a hearing. The employer would have to get a medical expert or factual evidence to challenge the period of disability and then go to a hearing based upon a termination petition. no matter what the board decides, if the board would decide in favor of the employer and say
that there was no disability,
there's no more disability as of the date of the hearing, you are terminated, or the date of filing the petition, you are terminated.
That means the employer would have paid benefits for a couple of months.
Correct.
That weren't ultimately necessary.
Here's the problem with that scenario, Your Honor. What does the claimant then do in order to restart his or her disability benefits? If you create the unrebuttable presumption, all the claimant has to do is get another work note from its doctor or her doctor that says that she's disabled, present it to the employer, and the unrebuttable presumption starts again. And then you've got this continuous cycle.
I don't see any case law or other suggestion that this thing just keeps cycling over and over again. I would think that when you get a determination from the board that you do not have a disability, that there has to be significant change circumstances before you could again rely on, well, my doctor says that I can't work.
Well, that's
and plus, you know, we've never been presented with that parade of horribles kind of case. If you forget about a recycling claim, what's the problem with encouraging the employer to move quickly when the employer may believe that this claimant ultimately will not prevail on getting benefits, and in the meantime, the claimant is entitled to rely on the doctor's evaluation?
Well, you deprive the employer of its right to challenge, its right to question based upon the facts and evidence. You also deprive the board of the opportunity to review the evidence and make a determination on the period of disability if it's questioned.
Why do you deprive them of any of those things?
Because the board would be ultimately responsible for paying a period of disability that it may not be responsible for. This case is a classic example of that, where a petition to terminate is filed based on a January 10th note that is arguably invalid without any explanation by the doctor. And this claimant could just show up and say, here's my note from my doctor, give me disability benefits, and we wouldn't be able to explore.
So you're suggesting that doctors, as a general rule, are going to give out these pieces of paper saying you can't work when they don't believe that their patients actually need to be off work?
I'm not saying it as a general bright-line rule. I'm saying that it can happen, it may happen, and in this case, it did happen.
And if it does happen, isn't there room for the bad faith determination?
There certainly is, but then how does the employer then regain the benefits that it has already paid out? It can't. If it proves that the doctor has acted without reasonable justification and is effectively acting in bad faith, which is a very high standard, then the employer cannot regain the benefits that it has paid out, and those benefits may be substantial depending upon when that hearing takes place.
Wouldn't there be a claim against the doctor? I mean, if the doctor was acting in bad faith and caused the legal process to be manipulated?
I suppose you could file a claim against the doctor, but you could also, I think it's more appropriate to have an avenue to argue before the Industrial Accident Board the sufficiency of the evidence and whether someone has an entitlement to benefits or not.
Does this rule exist around the country?
It's a good question, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that, whether Gilley or Belfast applies to each and every jurisdiction in the United States.
I didn't see any citations to Larson's on it, on workers' comp.
I did not. I note that I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just briefly in rebuttal, if I may. To sort of continue with that policy, the policy issues that the court was asking about, I do think a bright-line rule serves the interests of workers' compensation in general.
Has it been adopted around the country, do you know?
In this jurisdiction, it goes back to the late 1960s that the claimant has the right to rely on the treating physician. Larson is not referenced in the Gilliard-Belfast decision. It escapes me at the moment whether Malcolm versus Chrysler depended for support on Larson. I would be interested to check that, but I can't answer you this at this moment.
Filed the petition for, for total disability.
That's right.
Based on the January note issued by Dr. Nathans?
Correct.
But you're now backing away from that note and relying on the note that was subsequently issued by Dr. Ballou a month later. Is that correct?
I think that Gilliard-Belfast applies with equal force to both notes. I
so
think
which one are you relying on? Because the impression I got from your brief and from your argument today is that you're basically running backwards from Dr. Nathan's note and relying squarely on Dr. Ballou's later note.
I think
which is it?
I think Dr. Ballou's later note squares very well with the existing case law, particularly Clements.
Which are you relying on?
I don't think that they're different as Gilead-Belfast applies to them. I will take what the court finds appropriate.
Well, you petitioned for benefits from which date?
January 10th. That's the date in the petition. That's the date on which she has a work note on which she's entitled to rely until the board tells her different. There's a second note also, but I think that one starts things off.
So when I asked you at the beginning of your argument, you know, what the period of reliance was, and you said February 2nd, I believe. You didn't really mean that.
I think that's what's in the record. That's what's supported by the record. I think that we don't have an explanation for that, and the board was troubled by that, as is the court. I think that there are no problems in that respect with Ballou's note in February in light of the Clements decision. I see also that I am out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement and have a brief recess.